Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today is Lorianne Goldstein. You probably know her as a successful young adult novelist. Today, however, we're talking about her debut historical novel for adults. Inspired by the musical hit Hamilton, Love, Theodosia takes place during the post-American Revolution era. And after seeing the musical, Lorianne did what many writers might have done. She started questioning, what if? What if? And that led to her reimagined tale of Theodosia Burr, a vibrant feminist ahead of her time, and her love story with Philip Hamilton. Lots of challenges along the way there. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Lorianne Goldstein is a creative writing instructor. She is the author of four novels for young adults and credits her experience in journalism with giving her the skills and desire to conduct the extensive research that it took to write this adult historical debut. As I said, it's a reimagined story, but she really did intense research on these real life characters to bring them to this story. And the book again is Love, Theodosia. Here's my guest, Lorianne Goldstein. Lorianne Goldstein, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Vicki. It's great to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it's always great to see a different kind of story, and this is a different kind of story. But before we get into Love, Theodosia, I want to just share a little of your background with our listeners, since you and I have not talked before. And I know you have a background in journalism and teaching creative writing. At what point in your life did you decide, I'm going to be a writer?
Well, in terms of moving from my journalism career to fiction, I started writing fiction about 2013, and I kind of made that transition because I wasn't finding exactly the kind of satisfying work I was hoping in my journalism field. Boston at that time was a very tech-heavy publishing environment, and I had my first few jobs in this tech publishing world. And after that, everybody said, "Terrific! You do tech publishing, writing, editing." And that was never my dream, but I kind of kept rolling into that from job after job. And I kind of took a step back and said, "I love to write. I love to read. How about I combine that in fiction?" Which I had never done before. I don't believe I had ever even taken a creative writing course in college, so it was completely new to me. And boy, was it a learning experience!
I'm sure. And I would think that actually teaching creative writing, which I see that you do, I would think that's like a continuous learning situation, really.
It definitely is. And I came to teach creative writing after I had written my first couple of novels and kind of felt like I had much more of a grounding in how you do this thing and how you put story together and plot and how you create characters who feel like real people. And then I kind of moved into the world of teaching as well as writing. But it is a constant learning process. And I feel like every time I read a book, I learn something new to apply my own work. Every time I teach a student and read their work, I learn something to apply to my own work. And my books are, you know, reflective of who I was as the writer at the time. You know, if I wrote my very first book again today, it would be different just by the nature of what I've learned and where I am in my life.
Yeah. And this is always exciting, I think, when authors cross genres, because up until now you've written for young adults. But I've heard you describe Love, Theodosia as a passion project. So is that what prompted the switch to historical fiction with the character herself?
Absolutely. The idea dictated where the story would go and what type of story it would be. So I've written four young adult novels. And I was sitting in the audience pre-pandemic watching Hamilton for the first time, the musical in New York City. And I generally am not a musical fan, so I'll preface it with that. So it was unusual for me to kind of fall as deeply in love with the story of Hamilton as I did. but I also don't like spoilers. So I don't even like to watch a movie trailer before I watch the movie. So I went into Hamilton completely blind. I had only heard the first song, but I didn't know anything else about the music, about the story. I hadn't heard anything else. So this was all new to me. And I was sitting in the audience watching, and they reached the song Dear Theodosia, which is kind of a love letter of sorts from Aaron Burr to his newborn baby daughter, Theodosia. And it's also a duet with Hamilton, and they're singing of the fathers they wish to be, the world they want to pass on to these children. And just immediately, this Romeo and Juliet tale popped into my head. What would happen if these two children, born about the same time, about a year apart, two very famous flawed fathers who were instrumental in the foundation of this new country, what if these two children grew up and fell in love? And how would that play out? And that was just the inspiration. I went home and started Googling, and one of the very first things I found was that Theodosia and Philip, the two children, had attended the same French school for a while when they were younger. They ran in the same circles in New York society, and that's when this idea of a what-if story began to grow some legs that I felt like I could truly dig into. And because I was under contract for other books, this was something I kind of touched as I could. And I just kept finding myself returning to it. And it was a story, regardless of what was going to happen with it, which was an entirely new genre for me, I was going to finish and see what became of it.
Yeah, and it does sound like it was a passionate project since you kept coming back to it that way. It sounds like that story was drawing you to it and saying, you must write me. So let's just reiterate, we're talking about real life characters here, but the story itself is fiction, or reimagined, as they like to call it nowadays, right?
Yes.
Why did you choose to do it that way? Because you have written nonfiction. Why did you choose to do it this way versus a nonfiction story about Theodosia?
I think a couple of things there. As I did research, there are some things we know about Theodosia, but we don't have an extensive amount of information about her the way you do about her father, or the way you do about Alexander Hamilton or some other historical figures. And there had been an older biography of her that took some liberties even at that time, because, again, a lot of what we know about her is narrow, related to her father, a little bit about when she does marry in life and who she marries. But she, Theodosia herself, was lost at sea at the age of 29, and she was traveling from South Carolina to New York to see her father, and the boat just disappeared. And there are a lot of theories about what may have happened, but we never know what really happened to her. And on that boat were a lot of the personal correspondence that Theodosia had written to her father and him to her, and a lot of other family papers. She was taking them back to him. They were just completely lost to history. So we don't know a tremendous amount about her. We know some facts. And so to do a nonfiction book, I didn't feel like I would really get to explore her in the full depth that I hoped and wanted to. And since we knew certain facts and important facts about her, what we didn't know were the motivation and why she did certain things. And that's where my fictional brain really kind of latched on to being true to the essence of who Theodosia was, and then trying to understand why she may have made some kind of interesting and peculiar decisions in her life, and what her relationship with her father would have been like. Because as much as this is an imagined story of romance between Philip and Theodosia, it also is about her very complicated and deep relationship with her father. And that is based on as much history as I could find and put in the book.
Right. So a couple of things there I want to spin off. First of all, you talked about the essence of who she is. And this is always a challenge, I think, when people tell reimagined stories. We can capture facts and events and situations and maybe even conversations from, you know, letters and recorded history. But how do you actually capture that essence? What kind of drilling down did you have to do to feel, yes, I've captured her essence here?
I think for me, for Theodosia, she was a highly educated woman, and a highly educated woman for the time. Women were not educated the same way that males were, and her mother and father were very, thought it was very important for her to be educated the way she would have been had she been a son. And so she was kind of an anomaly for her time. She didn't exactly fit in with her peers and the other young women of her age. And she was gossip fodder in New York City society, and she knew it. Yet she didn't mind it. She almost relished having this intellect. What held her back was the inability to do the same career that men at the time could have done. And I felt like that was a very good basis for me to relate kind of personally to what that must have been like and felt like, you know, where women today are obviously doing tremendous things, but there's still those glass ceilings that need to be broken, and there's still struggles, and there's still a lot of issues when women try to reach the tops of their careers. And I felt like I could very much relate to how Theodosia must have felt at that time. So I think it was a little bit understanding what the time was for a woman like Theodosia and bringing kind of my own thoughts and feelings and emotions to where I imagined her to be.
Yes, I mean, it was a difficult time back then. I remember my brother had these 1800 encyclopedias from 1800s, and it said a woman should be educated enough so that she can have scintillating conversation for her male counterparts, but she must not be too educated, for she will not marry. She must not become a doctor, for example. So for somebody like Theodosia, who had this intelligence and wanted to do things, she had ambition too. It must have been trying at times. I want to talk about the relationship with her father, because as you said, they were quite close. She was very supportive of him, but he was quite a controversial figure, Aaron Burr. So tell us a little bit about their relationship.
They had an extremely strong and tight relationship. Burr was away for much of her growth and childhood, and her mother passed away when she was 11. And since her father was, whether he was in Philadelphia or other places for his political career, they were physically not in the same place. But he was a huge letter writer, and he implored her to write to him constantly when he was gone. And he had a comment in one of his letters to her about her that he wanted her to sit and chronicle her day for him for an hour every evening. And then he said he conceded that that might be too much for a girl of 11 or 12. So he said, how about just 10 minutes? But he wanted to know everything about his daughter's life, what she was studying, who she talked to, even down to what she ate. And he would give her guidance that he thought she needed to become the woman he wanted her to be, which in some ways was a female version of himself. But they developed this relationship through letters. And they were very, very close. She was his personal confidant, his political confidant, especially as she got older. As I said, her mother died when she was young, yet a lot of their letters when she, you know, got a little bit older into her teen years and later, her father would be writing her about his love interests and his sexual exploits. And these were things that just seemed unheard of for us even now. But they had a very unique and strong relationship, and the times were actually a little bit different. There was a lot of kind of joking and sarcasm regarding love and sex that I don't think we realized was at this time. That all changed when we got to the Victorian era a little bit later, in the later 1800s, the mid-1800s and on. But there was this kind of freer moment, even in this late 1790s to early 1810s or so, where it was not as taboo a subject as we think it was. So the idea that this was in some of their letters to each other sounds a little extreme, but it was not as shocking for the time. Yet it did mean that they talked about everything in their lives, whether it was love, ambition, politics, down to, you know, order this ham for this dinner party.
Right, right. And so tell us a little bit about Philip Hamilton. He seems to lack the ambition that Theodosia does. Was that true of him in real life, or is that something you built up in the story? To give us a little conflict there.
It was a little of both. There's grounding for him having a bit of less ambition. Alexander has a quote about him, you know, being a bit too playful, kind of maybe not taking things as seriously. So I kind of built on that. There's also a letter that Alexander writes to Philip that is entitled Rules for Philip Hamilton, and it details his day at, you know, 9 o'clock you do this, at 10 o'clock you do this, you study from this hour to this hour, this is your hour of recreation. So very much the idea of dictating Philip's day to keep him focused on school and to keep him focused on what Alexander wanted to be, a career in law for Philip, which he never actually gets to. So some of it was based in what I saw of true historical fact, and then kind of amplified and embellished in the book in order to have this real contrast between Philip and Theodosia, two children of fathers who had a high expectations of them, two children who were highly educated, but one being a male and one being a female meant their paths would be very different. So I wanted to also give them emotional conflict as well, of Philip perhaps being a little lazier and Theodosia looking at that and saying what I would do if I were a male. So that was kind of a little bit more where the imagination came in.
Right. Now, your story takes part over the span of, a year and a half. So why did you choose to do it that way versus longer form?
It was dictated by that inspiration of wanting to tell this Romeo and Juliet story, which would involve Philip. And by the nature of fact, and anybody who's seen Hamilton will know Philip's fate does end when he is a young man. So if I wanted to tell that as my, grounding of the story, history dictated how long, when the story would stop.
Right.
Now, I could have perhaps integrated that among a longer, more epic story of Theodosia's life, full life. But as I looked at what was the most important things that happened to Theodosia, this year of 1800 was a pivotal one in her life. It changes the course of what her life becomes dramatically. She was integral in her father's bid for the presidency in that year of 1800, and I felt like I could really write that year and a half in her life to get into, as I was talking about, why does she make these decisions and what were her motivations for doing these things that guided who she would become post 1801. And this just felt like it had the richest amount of history for me to dig into about her.
Right. And tell us some of the challenges that you faced writing historical fiction, especially since this was the first time you've delved into this. Imagination can take us so far with the characters, but we still have time and place and setting, and even dialogue is slightly different. So what kind of considerations went into that? What did you find challenging?
I found all of it challenging.
I like it when I get an honest answer.
And I think, as we're talking about the learning and craft and how writing is and teaching is a continuous learning process, it definitely is. And I think I'm glad that the idea for this story came at this point in my career. I'm not sure I would have been up to the tasks that were involved in this had this been my debut novel, and I think I was fortunate to have written a few other books to get a really good grasp on all of those storytelling and plotting elements. So I felt like I had, a good basis to be able to go into something brand new that does bring its own challenges. So I am glad that it came at this point in my career, but I am fortunate to have a bit of a type A personality and a little bit of that journalistic background, so I could go into this saying, what do I need to research and what do I need to learn, and be able to organize it and be able to not go down too many rabbit holes, because I've heard from other historical fiction writers that, you could research a historical novel for years and years and years on end. And how do you bring that in to research the things you really need to know for the story? So I had some ability to do that just personality-wise and what I've done in the past. But kind of the where and how do you put pieces together? You read a biography of Aaron Burr that the biographer has one tilt and presents him this way, and another biographer might present him differently. Well, how do I compile all of these things I'm reading to still represent what I believe history to be when you have, all these different sources? I went to the New York Public Library, which has a great stash of photographs and drawings for me being 1800, of what New York City looked like. So I could see what streets would have looked like and what people were wearing and the pigs eating the garbage in the middle of the street, and kind of get that grounding for setting. But translating all of that research into the page in a way that's engaging for the reader without feeling like a lecture, still being fiction, I think was a challenge that I had to figure out, because you could put so much more of the history in, and I think most fiction readers would say, this is not supposed to be a nonfiction book. I'm reading a book, yes, to be steeped in the history, but I still want to be entertained. So some of that balance for me was a lot of the work I had to center myself on making sure I didn't go too far down the road with those historical elements and kept it still entertaining and fiction and kept the plot and the storyline at the forefront.
Right. I can see that might be a problem for some writers because, you know, readers like to have a certain amount of leeway to imagine themselves. And so to get too tied up in historical facts, I can see would be a problem for sure. So talk about the language and how you approached the dialogue for this.
That was one of the other things that I definitely had to work a lot on. You know, if you write a historical fiction novel of this age, and you try to write it the way you read letters, no one would want to read that.
Right.
Wrote letters right. In a much more formal, almost roundabout way that you read some of these letters and you're like, what did they just say? Apparently even that letter writing written in that style was not how people spoke at the time even. So if you tried to write dialogue in that manner, it even wouldn't be historically accurate. Yet you don't want to be overly modern because you don't want to suspend that belief that you are in this moment of 1800. So finding the match in the dialogue to say it's got a tone of formality and a tone of a bygone era, but it is still what a modern reader would understand and could relate to, saying exactly as you're saying, readers like to kind of feel themselves in the story. And if you go too far on that formality, you're going to lose that. But you don't want to go too modern either. And that was actually something that my editor and I worked on together. That was one of the pieces she brought to it. That at times she said, this is a bit too formal, let's kind of modernize it. And finding that right balance between those two things, especially for the dialogue, was part of my revision process.
Hmm. And let's talk a little bit about how the transition from writing young adult to writing historical fiction. Was it as different as you thought it might be, or maybe not that different because there are certain elements that are going to be the same?
I think it was very different because of that kind of tone that I was switching from young adult to adult, so that's one change. And then not just adult, but historical fiction. I had spent time really understanding and honing what I think of as my YA, my young adult voice, and what readers expect and what the genre expects. And this is very different than that. And finding something that still felt me, authentic to my voice and the way I write, yet matched the genre and category that I was writing in, was definitely a challenge. And I think it was, I don't know if it was harder than I thought it was going to be. I knew it was going to be difficult, and it lived up to being difficult. But once I got into the, before I got into the writing, when I was doing kind of the plotting and the setup for the novel, in some ways that was easier, and not just because I'd done it before in different books, but when you're dealing with historical fiction and you're staying true facts and timeline, you have some built-in plot points. I knew
right.
The exposure was going to do certain things, and so it was almost, the plotting was easier. And I've talked to other historical fiction writers who have said the same thing. It's maybe a little known secret that, you're a leg up on kind of what's going to happen in the story because you're using history as part of your guide. So that actually was an unexpected thing to make it easier.
Right. Did you feel, when you're so embedded in something like this and you've done such intense research and then you've, fleshed out the essence of who Theodosia was, did you have a sense of loss when you'd finished this book, or did you just feel job well done?
The ending of this novel was very, very difficult to write. It's very pivotal, the culmination of a lot of emotional thread throughout the book and difficult decisions, and it was so draining to write that scene and over and over and over again. So I had a little bit of sense of like, whew, it's done. but I did find myself I gave myself a week or two, but not being willing to set it aside for that long. I wanted to go back in that world and kind of do my first revision pass and my second revision pass because I really just did love being in it, and part of this was written during the pandemic, and it was an escape. It was going somewhere completely different and spending my day in different people and a whole different world, and it was a very nice way to kind of spend the worst those early days of the pandemic were love Theodosia for me.
I can imagine you're in this wonderful world and then all of a sudden you come back to reality and think, oh, pandemic. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I can imagine. What are your favorite scenes to write and why?
I do love scenes with dialogue, whether it's my young adult books or here. I often joke that I could just write a book that's straight dialogue and other people say, well, then just write a play.
True.
So I do love that. I love kind of the interplay between a couple of characters, whether it's Theodosia and Philip or Theodosia and her father. I like the challenge of trying to capture so much context and subtext just in dialogue. So those are always kind of my favorite scenes to write.
And what typically, excluding the ending of this, but what typically are the most challenging for you to write?
The most challenging for me are scenes that rely heavily on setting or heavily on scene description of grounding. I tend to lose, there's a scene where they're dancing, which I loved writing, but I kind of like lose my grip on like where are they and where did they just come from and those logistics and trying to translate that onto the page so it's clear to the reader. Those are challenging for me, but also I'm not the hugest lover of intricate description of settings in novels. It's just a personal preference. So because I don't necessarily love it as a reader, I shy away from it as a writer. But it's certainly in historical fiction, you have to do that. You have to have good grounding of setting and the elements that bring that time period alive. So that was the hardest parts of this to write.
Right. I'm going to throw a couple of words out here and just tell me what pops into your head when I say them, what they mean to you, what these words mean to you. First one is discipline.
Discipline is something that I think gets a negative connotation, but I think it's the only way, first of all, that I could be a writer, to be disciplined, be working at home and to have a schedule and to ensure I stick to it and I hold myself accountable to it. So I think discipline, that often can be a negative, I look at it as a positive.
Right. How about spontaneity?
Spontaneity is something that is definitely encapsulated by the character of Philip in this book and something that is not my forte, and I wish it were. So I would very much like to be more like Philip.
And what does success mean to you as an author?
You know, success is one of those things as an author that is a bar that always moves. When you start out writing, you just want to get an agent. Great, you get an agent. You just want to get a book deal. Great, you get a book deal. You want to get another. You get another and, okay, you want this book to be successful, which means, does it get more readers? Does it sell more copies? And that can be a straight numbers game that makes you lose sight of the fact that you're doing something that you love and you're getting emails, notes on social media from people who read your book and love it and take the picture and post it. And that's a measure of success as well. And I think it can be hard to balance those two things and not place too much emphasis on the straight numbers game and make sure you place enough on that more emotional side of touching readers.
Right.
So in an ideal world, it would be the balance of the two. But, you know, that can be a hard place to live as an author.
I would imagine, definitely, yeah. I know you said you're a type A personality, but there are times when all of us feel like quitting. Even if we don't, we feel like it at some time. When you are in that mode and the going gets tough, what keeps you going?
My writer friends keep me going. And, you know, I think anyone who's a writer can relate to this. But, you know, I quit writing with every book I write. To the point where I say, I'm done, why am I doing this? And I have a couple of really strong writer friends who we've known each other, you know, for 10 years. And one of them we meet twice a week on Zoom and we write together. We sprint, do writing sprints together, and then we chat and we do writing sprints and we chat. And that camaraderie and support and being able to talk about the good and the bad of it, and even brainstorm ideas for the books that we're writing with one another. Without writing friends, those moments where you feel like you want to quit, for me at least, could take over.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I write nonfiction, but the thing is, during the pandemic, you know, you are alone so much with your work. And then, of course, we were all isolated too. It can get a little bit much. So tell us what you've taken away from this experience during the pandemic. I ask most people what they learned during that time about themselves or about life in general that they want to carry forward with them.
You know, I learned that it is really hard for me to prioritize pure enjoyment and pure fun. And I think coming from somebody who has worked from home for quite a long time, there's always been that inability to disconnect work and life. You know, when you work at home and your computer's there, you can always send one more email, you could always write one more chapter, you could always read one more research article. And it's very, very difficult to break that and say, this is work time, and now I'm kind of giving myself permission to stop working and do something else. And the pandemic helped with that in certain ways. It made it harder in other ways, because my husband was also home and he was working, and we kind of negatively reinforced the always working. But as time went on, we realized we need to take some more time for ourselves and let the work sit. And if it was a beautiful day, let's drive to the beach and let's go for a walk on the beach, even if it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, because we know we'll make up the hours later. And that is something that I actually learned more through the pandemic and would hope I will keep forward, of that prioritizing of, quote unquote me time, or quote unquote just some downtime, letting my brain rest.
Right. Well, it's a very, very valuable lesson. And you're a woman after my own heart, because I read that you have never met a beach you don't love. And I do the same thing. I look at the weather and I think, you know what? I can get out here for a couple of hours. I can work up tonight or get up early tomorrow and finish the rest of it. So,
yeah. It's good to have a happy place.
Yeah. So I know listeners can find out much more about you, Laurie, at lauriegoldsteinbooks.com, lauriegoldsteinbooks.com. And the book, of course, is called Love, Theodosia, a novel of Theodosia Burr and Philip Hamilton. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
You know, I want to make sure that listeners, whether they're readers or writers, enjoy what they're reading or they're writing. I think at times in this world of entertainment, people are quick to say, oh, you know, that's a beach read, or, you know, that's fluff, or why aren't you reading nonfiction, or why are you reading nonfiction? And as a writer and as a reader myself, I just always say, read what you love, write what you love, and that's all that matters.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much, Laurie Ann Goldstein, for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.